Throughout the Gospels, Jesus told stories, but not just any old stories. Stories that were powerful, informative, and transformative. These parables were the basis for how he taught and our best insight into how he views the world. Join us this fall for a study in the parables as we look at the moral of the story. And now, here's today's message.
All right. Hey, good morning. Welcome to Northgate. My name is John. If I don't know you, my name is John. I'm one of the pastors here. I guess if I do know you, those same two things are still true either way. But I'm glad you're here. Good to worship with you this morning and then continue this series. If you were here last week, Bishop Roller started out a new series for us called The Moral of the Story, where we look at some of the different parables. We're going to kind of unpack them. If you're paying attention, you realize this week we're talking about the prodigal son. Hopefully you picked that up. It was subtle. But I want to just mention a couple things before we get into it. One was we talked about the Bishop's Famine and Relief Fund in regards to Hurricane Harvey and Hurricane Irma. And I just wanted to report back to you. The last number I'd heard was that people had given from Northgate, those that gave it through us and not directly to the fund, $2,155 to the relief there, which we celebrate. But what I think is really cool too, yeah, it'd be appropriate to clap if you want. I was saying last night, I think the coolest thing with this, or when you guys gave $20,000 additional dollars to Gahanda, Rwanda, is that those things happen, and we continue to reach our regular levels of tithes as far as the budget. And so when people are doing this, it's just out of the generosity of their hearts on top of what they are already giving. And that's incredible. I mean, that's something that not everybody gets, and we celebrate the generosity that you guys live out on such a regular basis. Now, one other thing to mention before we jump in, we've talked a lot about Right Now Media, and Pastor Greg isn't paying me to say this. I mean, you could if you want to. But I use this. There's a really cool thing called Prodigal Perspectives on there, which was cool. It's kind of this one-man play where one section, he was the younger brother, one he was the older brother, one he was the father. And it was really cool, and it was really helpful and informative to me. So give that to you as a plug. If you'd like to check that out later, you can watch that. Or if you're in a group and you're looking for some more discussion material, that'd be a really cool thing to check out. So we're in Luke 15, and if you notice when the passage was read in the video, we started at verse 11, and it's always important to kind of look at the context of what we're talking about. So in this context, there's this regular narrative through the Gospels that Jesus is hanging out with, like, the tax collectors and sinners. He's not, like, buddy-buddy with all the religious people, with the, you know, the pious people, and they don't like that. They would prefer that he hung out with religious people like them, that he followed the rules, that he played their games their way. And so he's getting frustrated, and he kind of wants to communicate to them exactly what's important to God. He's like, how can I communicate what's most important to God? And so he goes into these three different parables that illustrate the importance of lost things. And so you can see those parables before the one we're going to look at, but he gives the parable of the lost sheep. And he's like, if you have 100 sheep, and one of them wanders away, what do? You go and you find it, and you bring it back. And when you find it, you celebrate that lost sheep. You celebrate that you got that sheep back. And then he goes into the parable of the lost coin, and he says, if you had 10 silver coins and you lost one of these coins, what would you do? You turn the light on, you'd look around, you'd go under everything over it until you found the coin, and when you found that coin, you would celebrate that you lost the coin and you got it back. And then he goes into the parable of the lost son. And the parable of the lost son is frequently called the parable of the prodigal son. It's the word that we've used here. Just because I think words matter, it is important to note, prodigal and lost aren't like interchangeable words, okay? Prodigal, it means somebody that spends money or resources freely and recklessly. It's someone that is wastefully extravagant. So just for what it's worth, don't use those two interchangeably. The prodigal part is about how he lived when he was lost. But Jesus tells this story. And he said, if you have two sons and one of them walks away from you, when he returns, what you do is you celebrate. Because what is valuable to God is not just what he already has, it's in what he has lost returning to him. And this third parable that we're going to look at, that we're going to unpack this morning, will show us some incredible lessons, some incredible reminders about what is so amazing about God's grace. Now, I'm going to kind of walk through and tell you the story, and I can take a lot of liberty with that since you've already heard the full passage. But as we do, I just kind of want you to keep your eyes open for what our main point is today. Watch for these principles of grace in this account. God's grace is undeserved, it's enduring, and it's impartial. Very much of all three of those things, and we'll come back to that, but just kind of keep your eyes open as we walk through this parable about how God's grace is undeserved, enduring, and impartial. So Jesus, he's talking about the sheep, he's talking about the coin, and then he turns his attention to this family. And he says that there was once a man, and it would turn out that this man was very wealthy. We don't know that right now, but this rich man had two sons. Now, they kind of fit the birth order roles because the younger son, he's the adventurous one. He's the one that doesn't want to be held down by the hard work of his father's fields and vineyards anymore. I mean, he's worked enough. He's been doing this his whole life, and he is ready for the world, or he thinks that he's ready to go experience the world. And so he goes to his father, and he makes this unimaginable request, and he says simply, give me my share of the estate. Now, as Bishop Roller mentioned last week in a different context, at that time in Jewish law, the oldest son would get a double share. So if there's two sons, the oldest son would get 66 and a, you know, two-sixths or two, well, I don't know, I'm terrible at math, 66%. Call it 67 if you want. And the younger son would get 33%. And so what he's saying is a few things here. He's just saying, Dad, you know what? I wish that you were dead now so that I could get my 33% of everything and I could get out of here. I could be done working for you. I could be done living here. I could be done doing this. And it was a spit in the face. I mean, it was an absolute spit in the face. It was a horrendously insulting and hurtful thing to ever ask. It's the kind of thing that maybe in a weak moment you think about asking. You think, oh, you know what I'd like to do? Ask Dad for 33% and get out of here. But it's not the kind of thing that you would ever actually say out loud. But he does. He says it. And we can imagine the pain, the hurt that the father feels, the rejection, the feeling of being discarded even after everything that he's provided for his son, all that he's given him, all that he's laid out, the life that he has set up for him, and he just has this feeling of pain as his son rejects him and rejects that. But Jesus says in the account, in the parable, that the father did it. He gave the son what he wished for. He divided the property, and he gave him his inheritance early. And so heartbroken and undoubtedly just devastated by this, he lets his son go as he wishes. Now, not long after that, the son gathers all his things up that he owns, and he gathers this money up, and he leaves. He gets his wish at the small price of his father's devastation, at the small price of his father's broken heart. Now, if you think about that day on the farm, that must have been a pretty miserable day when the son actually left. You know, as the dad stands there, probably with the older brother, and he watches him walk down that path. Because the father, he's older and he's wiser, and he knows that this son has the perfect mixture of what he needs to make a huge mess. He's got a lot of money, he has no experience, and even worse than that, he has the self-confidence and belief that he knows everything he needs to know to take on the world. And so as this dad watches his son walk away, just imagine his heartbreak for what he knew he was going to face. But the son, he sets off to a distant country. He goes, he's going to go find out what the world is all about. In our time, it's probably like New York City or Los Angeles. You know, he's got to go and get in the big city and find out what he's made of, find out if he can make it in the world. And he will find out what the world's all about, but it turns out the world can be a pretty harsh place for somebody in his shoes. So it moves on to say very quickly that he blows through all of his money in, quote, wild living. Now, we don't know exactly how long that took, but this man was very wealthy, and he just gave him a third of his estate. So we're talking about a pretty good amount of money, and because of that, I think it's a pretty educated guess to say we're talking months and years that it took him to blow through this. Probably not days and weeks, but he blows through it on wild living. Now, wild living also is not specifically defined, but some things haven't changed that much, so we can take a pretty good guess that it's like alcohol, drugs, maybe some gambling, probably some, let's call them unsavory women are involved, and he blows through this inheritance. Now, just about the time that he runs out of money, suddenly he finds that everyone who was his friend when he was rich, when he had all this money, is no longer his friend now that he has nothing. And as that happens, there's a severe famine in the whole country. And so he's completely broke. He's unemployed. He's now in a distant land with no family and no friends. He has nothing. He is nothing. And for the first time in his life, he has no one, nothing to turn to. And so he makes this choice of self-preservation. He does probably the only thing you can do at this point. He decides, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go find a job. I'm going to find a job because how else was he going to continue living? But he doesn't have any connections. He doesn't have any real marketability for an entitled punk. And so he ends up in a disgusting field feeding pigs. That's what he can do. Keep your LinkedIn profile updated, right? That's one of his mistakes that he made. He didn't have that ready to go. But he's in that field and he's so hungry, he's starving, that he becomes jealous of what the pigs are eating. He looks at how the pigs are fed and he says, you know, I don't even have that. And then finally, in that moment, in the lowest moment, which tends to be where some of us do our very best thinking, which tends to be the point where we come to these kind of realizations, he has this moment of clarity. And he says, you know who hires a lot of servants and treats them way better than I'm being treated right now? You know who actually feeds his servants and not only gives them food, but gives them more than enough food? My Father. My Father does that. He's the answer. Why am I out here starving to death? So he's like, here's what I'll do. I'm going to go back, and I'll make a big speech, and I'll win him over. I'll start preparing that, and so we don't know how exactly, but he gathers enough money, begs, borrows, steals, whatever he has to do to get enough money together to begin to make that trip home. And on his way, I think he starts to work out his speech, and you saw that in the passage where he's like walking. He's like, all right, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. Yeah, that's good. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Yeah, that's true. I should say that. So please just make me like one of your hired servants. It's like, okay, that's good. So he's probably, you know, traveling along and he's saying, okay, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. And he gets this speech all together. But as he gets closer to home, things don't go exactly according to his plan, to how he had pictured it. Because while he was still a long way off, his father looked down the path and he saw him. And the passage says that the father's heart was filled with great compassion and with love for his son. And so he does this crazy thing. He runs to his son. Now, you got to understand, culturally, people, especially men, did not run in that culture. Like, it's not a lot for, you know, some of you would rather die than run, and they might coincide. I'm sorry. But it wasn't a thing that men did. It was considered undignified. You know, you're wearing a robe and stuff, and they did not run. Men did not run. It was this undignified thing to do. So for the father to see him while he's still a long way off and run to him is this extraordinary thing. It's this extraordinary statement that the father makes. And it says he's filled with compassion. He throws his arms around him. He hugs him and he kisses him. And now I can picture the son because he's got this speech planned, you know, where he's like, oh, like, Dad, hold on. I gotta say something. I've sinned against heaven and against you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. And before he even gets through the rest of the speech, the dad just cuts him off. He's like, no, he doesn't even want to hear the rest of the speech. He turns to the servants and he says, Quick, we've got some things to do. You, go grab my nicest coat. You, get my gold ring. Get the best ring. You, get my nicest sandals. Get the sandals that don't smell yet. Because sandals, you know sandals get a smell. And then he says to somebody else, all right, you, go kill a cow. You start the grill. Tonight we're having filet mignon. Like, we're going to do this, right? We're going to have a celebration. My son was dead. My son was gone. I thought I'd never see him again, but now he's alive. He's here. He's with us. He's been found. Drinks on me, everyone. You know what I'm saying? And they have that. And undoubtedly, even though it was like thousands of years from being invented, the DJ started with Celebrate Good Times. Come on. Like, that was the lead song. You know that's it. And because I'm not Greg, I'm not going to sing it, but I'll just mention it. But the story doesn't end there. The story doesn't end there because there's this issue of the older son, the one who never left. The hardworking, super responsible, firstborn son who's always done what he's supposed to do, who never quit, who never walked out, who never left and broke his father's heart and left him devastated there. He's actually still out working in the field while all this is happening. He's still out plugging away like a good, diligent, obedient son when he hears this party going on back at home. And he calls one of the workers over. He's like, hey, what's that all about? Is that a DJ? Like, what's going on down there? And the worker says, oh, you didn't hear? Your brother's back. It's awesome. Your dad's serving filet mignon for everyone. Come on, let's go. You should come down there. And the older brother is livid. I mean, he is beyond livid when we read his words. You know, in his mind, he's thinking, well, it turns out my brother isn't the only one that's lavish and that's wasteful in this family. Now, my dad is going to throw a stupid party for my stupid brother who never should have left in the first place and definitely shouldn't be rewarded for his stupidity now. And he keeps working in the field, and he refuses to attend the party. He refuses to go down there. And so the father realizes, and he asks somebody at the party, he's like, hey, where's Trent? Right? I don't know. The older brother seems like a Trent to me. It fits. And so he asks where he is, and he goes out, and he's like, come on, Trent. You know, I mean, I thought Brock was dead. The younger brother is definitely a Brock. That is if you want to have a rebellious second son, name him Brock. And I did look. We don't have any kids registered in the system that are named Trent or Brock because I do my homework. Don't get distracted. He said, Brock is back. I thought we'd never see him again. And now he's back. He's alive. He's home. Come and celebrate with us. And he looked at his father and he yelled at him. He said, look, I've been slaving away for you for years. And never once have I disobeyed you. Not once. And you've never even as much as grilled hot dogs for me and my friends. But he runs away. He blows a third of your money, a third of our money, trying to destroy himself. And when he backs himself into a corner to where he has no other options and suddenly decides to come home, you throw a party like this for him? It's like, no way, Dad. No way. And the father, and I think that his heart, again, is filled with compassion, just like it was when he saw the younger son a long way off. He looks at the older son and he says, oh, my son, you were always with me. You've always been an incredible son, and everything I have, the farm, the fields, the vineyards, the house, everything is yours. No one is going to take that away from you. But don't you see that we had to celebrate like this? Don't you see that we had to? Your brother was dead, and he's alive again. Your brother was lost, and now he's found. How could we not celebrate? And the story ends there, and as Jesus tends to do, it happens a lot. There's not really any resolution in this story. We don't get all the closure, right? We don't know if Trent decided to come down to the party or if he just stayed and worked. We don't know if, you know, Brock was humbled by this whole experience and went back to working the way that he should. But what we do get from this, what we do end up with, is some of the greatest and most powerful illustrations and insights into God's grace. Truthfully, I think in the entire Bible, these are some of the most powerful insights into God's love for us, into the love of God the Father. And so in our remaining time, I just kind of want to go through those and kind of talk about how they apply to us. And you remember the first one I gave you is that God's grace is undeserved. God's grace is undeserved. That's so clearly illustrated here, but that's the essence of God's grace. That's what God's grace is all about. It's unmerited, undeserved favor. None of us deserve it. I don't deserve it. You don't deserve it. Even Pastor Greg doesn't deserve it. Isn't that crazy? None of us deserve it. But somehow, some way, some of us get diluted into thinking that we actually do deserve it. But we see from this parable, the son wasn't welcomed back into the family because he deserved it. He wasn't welcomed back because of what he had done. He was welcomed back because of the father's grace, pure and simple grace and nothing else. Him being welcomed back in such a loving and a lavish way wasn't actually about the son at all. It was all about the father. It was all about the father. And the father is really the main character in this parable. He's a loving and forgiving father whose character remains constant throughout the story, and it's a beautiful picture of our God. And this is important because once we understand how undeserving we are of this grace, once we grasp that, then we're in the perfect position to see the importance of the second lesson, and that's that God's grace is enduring. God's grace is enduring. You see, this is important. Make sure we get this. Because if it was and is never deserved, that allows it to be enduring. If God's grace is not deserved, that's how it can be enduring. Because if we had to earn God's grace by being good enough, we had to earn God's grace by being loyal enough, then it wouldn't be enduring because it would be dependent on our behavior, on our actions. I've got great news for you this morning. It's not. It's not because it's enduring. The Father was always going to forgive the Son. Don't miss that part of this account. He was just waiting for him to come back. He was there. He saw him on the path while he was a long way off. He was always going to forgive him. Did it grieve the father that the son treated him like that and left? Absolutely. Of course it did. The question, though, for the son was not whether or not the father was going to forgive him. The question was, how many nights did he want to sleep in pig slop before he went home? I want you to hear this morning. Listen clearly. God will forgive you. He will. That is not the question. The question is, how many nights do you want to spend sleeping in the mess of your own sins before you have that moment of clarity and you go back to a good and loving God who is waiting there for you? That's the question that we have to answer, because God's grace is there for you. God's grace will continue to be there for you, but how long are we going to wait before we go back? Now, most of you know, because I've preached about it enough, that you know, I have a history of a problem with alcohol. That was a thing that just really wrecked a good portion of my life. But let me make this clear to you. I don't not drink now because I think that God wouldn't forgive me if I screwed up and did it one more time. I've got a good stretch, a lot of years of sobriety now, and it's been the best stretch of my life. But I know that if I somehow made a terrible decision for me to go and started drinking again, God would actually forgive me. I don't question that. But I don't do that, not because I think God wouldn't forgive me or couldn't forgive me, but because I got sick of living in the mess of my own sins to the point that I said, enough. Why am I going to continue living like this when I have a good and loving Father that's waiting for me, that has something better for me? So I want to talk to everyone that came in today full of guilt and shame and remorse, full of regret. The people who, when I said were undeserving of God's grace, knew all too well what I was talking about. I want you to hear this. God's grace is enduring. Now, when we sin, we separate ourselves from God, not vice versa. You know, just he lets us go. He's a God of free will. He's a God of choices. And just like the Father in our story, he will not force you to love him. He will not force you to stay against your will. But he is waiting for our return. And he's not only just waiting. I love the imagery. I love the picture of the Father running to the Son while he was still a long way off. I mean, what does that say to us about God's heart and his grace towards people that are in sin? To me, it reminds us that there is nothing that you have done that God will not forgive you for and allow you to return to a right relationship with him. He's waiting for you. How long will you spend in your sin before you go back? Because his grace is enduring. And then the third thing that we see from the oldest brother is that God's grace is impartial. We learn this lesson. The older brother, he represents the self-righteous people who've lost sight of what God's grace has done in their lives. They've experienced God's grace, but maybe they've done it enough, or they've gotten to a point where they forgot who they used to be, and they forget how important God's grace was to them. Bob Goff said, "Grace never seems fair until we need a little." Isn't that true? That like we look at somebody else receiving grace, like, oh, they don't deserve that. But when it's me, I deserve that. But that happens so naturally. We lose sight of where we come from so quickly. I love going to baseball stadiums. I've gone to a bunch. That's like on my retirement bucket list. When I retire, I'm just going to go to different baseball stadiums and take them all in. They're all different. They're unique. They're fun. And I was at the newer one in Cincinnati, the Great American Ballpark, with Amy and her brother and his wife. And the four of us went, and her brother was like, this is cool because no one actually comes here. Like, this isn't like Wrigley or Fenway, so we can like go right up to the 100-level section, even though our seats are up there. So don't think less of me, but we definitely did that. And we walked right up to the 100 level, you walk in, you don't like look, or you just go in like, yeah, these are my seats. And we sit down, and so we're watching this game, and it gets to be like the seventh inning, and even of the crowd that was there, people have started to clear out. And these people come down the aisle, and they kind of have this like, oh man, should we do it? Like they're going to get away with something. And they come, and I can see, obviously, these aren't their seats, and they walk in a couple rows in front of us, and they sit down right there. And you know what happened to my heart? I thought, those aren't your seats. I did. I like resented those people. I was like, those aren't, you shouldn't even be here. Get back up. Oh, and then I was like, oh, man, right? Isn't hypocrisy hard to see when it's yourself? But that's exactly what we do, right? We do that where we see people that are lost and are struggling and we forget, man, I was a mess. A lot of you guys were a mess too. You know that. But we look at somebody else that's in a mess and we think, oh, they'll never get it right. God shouldn't forgive them. God won't do that. So who's the family member? Who's the coworker? Who's the neighbor that we don't think is as deserving of God's grace as we are? Maybe you've said out loud, I can't believe that God would actually forgive them. Or maybe you just thought in your mind, I don't actually want God to forgive them. Who are those people? Because they're deserving of God's grace. I'm going to tell you, it was not easy. I did not want to do this. But for Amy and I to forgive the owners of the dog that bit Emerson's face, to go into court to the district attorney and to ask for leniency, to ask, you know, where this has been taken care of, we want you to do this, we don't want you to give them any bigger fine than you absolutely have to, and then to go outside of court and to shake their hands and say, we've forgiven you. That was not fun. That was not easy. It's not what I wanted to do, but God's grace is not limited to my comfort zone. God's grace is not limited to what I think people deserve or to what I think is fair, to what feels good to me. I've been given a lot of grace, and I have to extend a lot of grace. And we need to realize the places where we've become like the older brother. We need to ask ourselves, who do I write off? Is there anyone in my life that I don't feel is as deserving of the same forgiving and redeeming grace that's been extended to me? Because what I know about all of us is we are not going to encounter anyone this week that God does not love. And we're not going to encounter anyone in our week ahead who God's grace does not extend to. So God's grace to us, what he offers us, is just like the love of this father to the sons in the story. It's undeserving, it's enduring, and it's impartial. Now, I don't know where on that you fall this morning. I'm sure that there are people who came in feeling like they have to try and earn that grace, to deserve that grace. And I give you that reminder this morning that you don't deserve it and there's nothing you can do to earn it. That's why it's a free gift. That's why it's there for you. For some of us, man, you come in and you're thinking that God is not waiting for you, that God, he's mad enough at you that he doesn't want you to return. See very clearly in this Father that he is waiting for you to return. That grace is enduring and he's there. And for a lot of us, I'm sure that the part about grace being impartial, that's what really lands with us today, that we have somehow become stingy with what was given to us for free. And so that's our takeaway as we think about grace this morning. I don't want you to become stingy with what's been given to you for free. Don't be the older brother. If you have received God's life-changing, life-transforming grace, don't become stingy with that for anyone else. Share it freely. Share it openly. Share it as the Father shared his love with the son that we feel like deserved it and with the son that we feel like did not. Let's pray.
Thanks for joining us on the Northgate Podcast. We hope this message has been a blessing to you as you walk with Jesus Christ. For more resources, visit our website at northgatefmc.com or download the Northgate app. Have a wonderful week, and we'll see you next time.